My name's Roger Bolton, and this is the first in a series of podcasts interviews for the Religion and Media Centre. My guest this week is someone who knows more about the history of Anglicanism and the Church of England in particular than anyone else on the planet. He is Professor Dermot McCulloch, an English academic and historian specialising in ecclesiastical history and the history of Christianity, a fellow of St. Cross College, Oxford, emeritus professor of the history of the church at Oxford, and the author of numerous best-selling books, which have won even more number of prizes. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Professor. In a way, you were born into the Church of England, weren't you? Your dad was a priest.
Yeah, absolutely right. And my grandfather, a priest as well, of the Scottish Episcopal Church, so not the Church of England. So I do come from a family firm of clergy and know it from the inside.
And I was wondering whether you were still a member of the family firm, because you were ordained a deacon 1987, but you declined ordination to the priesthood, and you now describe yourself as, or you did in 2009, a candid friend of Christianity. Does that label still apply?
Declined is probably a polite way of putting it. I was not allowed to proceed to priestly orders. I've always been a person on the edge of things. I'm rather more inside that edge than I was back in 2009, in the sense that I have a lot to do with my local parish church. I take morning prayer, that sort of thing. And that seems to me a great quality of the Church of England. That it is, of course, an established church, the national church, but it's also classically a generous church, which realizes that it contains a huge variety of opinions, many of them contradictory. And so to be part of it is to be part of an enterprise which doesn't put too many stresses on you as to what you believe or why. And that seems to me entirely healthy.
That seems to me a very traditional view of the Church of England, but I wonder if it still applies. You didn't go forward after being ordained a deacon, or weren't allowed to, because you were open about your homosexuality, and you said, "I was brought up to be truthful, and I couldn't be truthful if I pretended in these circumstances." Was that the key reason why you felt you couldn't go forward?
Yes. I mean, what could be more important than being truthful as a minister of the church? It's all supposed to be about truth, whatever that might mean, the ambiguity of truth, but also the preciousness of truth. To conceal things, deliberately to conceal something, particularly as something as important as one's own sexuality, that's just not on. And clergy over the years, gay clergy, have had to do that. And that really isn't tolerable. I wasn't able to tolerate it in 1989-90. I'm certainly not going to tolerate it now. The Church of England has got itself in a real mess about this question. And it is not showing very good signs of sorting it out at the moment, I have to say.
Well, at the Lambeth Conference, which has just started, the 15th Lambeth Conference, delayed rather by the COVID epidemic, it runs from the 26th of July to the 8th of August, it has got itself in something of a confused state about homosexuality. It's been issuing things called, it issued calls, should I say, not affirmations and calls, not resolutions. And it had issued a call which gave bishops a couple of options about their attitude to homosexuality. They can gay marriage. They could either say that they thought gay marriage was wrong, or they could say it required further study. What they were not initially allowed to say was whether, in fact, they approved of it. And now, as a result of opposition, there's been some scuttling backwards and forwards. What do you make of all of that?
I'm astonished by it. I'm astonished by the sheer incompetence of all that. Here is a conference which has been delayed, and it's not just been delayed by COVID, it's been delayed by the fact that the Archbishop of Canterbury and those leading it wanted to get it right and make sure it was not confrontational. And then this huge act of incompetence and confusion, and also, frankly, dishonesty. There was something dishonest about these 10 calls. They're also rather unsatisfactory in that these are 10 calls made by 10 male bishops. And the Anglican Communion is much more than male bishops. And right at the last moment, one of these calls, which is about, ironically, human dignity, has this had this extraordinary catch-22 statement. Here's the classical view of Anglicanism, and it is not the mind of the Anglican Communion that you should have same-sex marriages. And you couldn't say, I don't believe that. All you can say is, oh, I might think a bit more about that. Now, that is so stupid. And it is also not what the drafting committee of these calls actually intended.
Some of them said, we don't know what happened. When the document left us, it didn't have that in it.
Yeah, the Bishop of Toronto, for instance, said this. He was not party to this statement. It wasn't there. Now, who slipped it in? And with what motive? And who signed that off? No one has yet told us those things. And this is the real problem about the leadership of the Church of England at the moment. It seems both incompetent and devious. And this is the worst possible quality in church leaders.
I was talking to a bishop yesterday who said, why do we light unnecessary fires and then spend a lot of energy, all our energy, extinguishing them? Do you share that view?
That's a rather good way of putting it, yes. And it's interesting, the fire is about sex, isn't it? It's all about sex. And it is quite clear now that there are two opposing views in the whole worldwide Anglican Communion on this. And one of them, it likes to call itself traditionalist, and the other is more open to the realities of human life, as well as looking at the realities of the theological tradition and what the resources there might be in them. And these two things are clashing over sex. Why over sex? Because in the tradition, there is a clear bias on one question about sex. And that's same-sex relations. It just doesn't seem to be possible for so-called traditionalists to move on because they're fixated with a particular view of what the Bible says. The Bible is not in favour of same-sex relationships, and that seems to be a product of the various times in which it was written. That's a function of the various times in which the Bible was written. But that's a phase. Let's face it, a phase in the creation of a religion called Christianity. Christianity is actually a very new religion. It's only been around for 2,000 years, a tiny, tiny fraction of human experience. And you would not expect it to get everything right in that time. It's got to dialogue with these books from the past, but it's a dialogue, a conversation. It is not just listening to what the books say and saying, okay, that's the end of the story.
Well, what's happened in the Anglican Communion over the last few days has raised again the question of whether it has any value. In 2008, we were all prepared for the last Lambeth Conference, the thing to blow apart, and yet somehow the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, managed to diffuse the issues and suggest to delegates who disagreed about sexuality there were rather a lot of other things they might wish to talk about: climate change, wars, famine, the relationship between the major faiths. Now, of course, 14 years on, climate change is even a greater problem. Do you think there's still value in the Anglican Communion if it can address other issues than sexuality?
Oh, I do, yes. There's an enormous value in it. It's got a shared history. And it's also got the, at its best, this rueful quality of being able to hold people, be hospitable to people with entirely different opinions. And this has actually been the case since its very early days in the 16th and 17th century. The issues were different, but the question, which is actually very basic to Christianity, what is the nature of Eucharist, the Mass, the Holy Communion, when bread and wine are shared? What's that mean? Well, there are violently opposed views on that in the history of the Anglican Communion. But it's a communion and not a church. And the trouble about the Lambeth Conference is that it gives the illusion that there is an Anglican church worldwide. And if you've got an Anglican church, it's probably got a leader, and that leader is the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's an entirely wrong way of looking at Anglicanism. And it's why it may be time to pull the plug on Lambeth conferences, because they're inclined to give that illusion to what should be a much more delicate, nuanced thing, the Anglican communion. And the danger with the Lambeth Conference at any stage is that it damages this very fragile thing, this structure, the Anglican communion. And just because it's fragile doesn't mean it's valuable. But it's like a fragile piece of sculpture or an ornament. You don't mess around with it. You don't use it as a football. And that's the problem with the Lambeth Conference.
Does it share some of the problems that with the United Nations, which is that there are such major differences that it's almost impossible on a whole range of issues to get agreement? Russia, China has a veto, for example. But people don't say, because of that, get rid of the United Nations. They say, well, what are the things the United Nations can do? We know what it can't do. We know what it can do. Do you think that needs to happen with the Anglican Communion, that it should recognise its differences, but not put them aside, but put them back a little, and then focus on a range of things that are more important? And what would you say those things ought to be that it should now focus upon?
Well, you've named them, Roger. We are facing extinction as a race, as a species, because of climate change. We have huge world inequalities, poverty, which stops people being themselves. These are big questions. These are the questions that really matter. And sexuality is just going to go its own sweet way, frankly.
And is the implication that if the church doesn't have anything to say on these non-sexual vital matters, in a way it will appear irrelevant to people?
Well, it does. And that's one of the reasons why church going has become a minority pursuit, because people look to a church and they don't see anything that really feels very important. And when what they do see, which is important, is churches saying bad things about their sexuality. Why would you go to such an institution?
Well, I do, but I don't think this is the occasion for me to explain why I do, but for a confused range of reasons.
But why should one go to such
a... Yes. Yes. Well, I have to explain this to my children, actually. And I do say, because in talking to my children, because things like, if you believe and you try to follow Jesus, you believe in society above all. We're not just a collection of individuals. We belong to a worldwide society. You believe that faith has everything to do with everything. And therefore, it has to do with climate change. It has to do with our relationships with people we disagree, and so on. But it is very difficult to get past the Victorian church, which stands in our way, both in terms of buildings and in terms of language often, certainly in terms of hymns. How do we change that? How's the Anglican Communion change that? Sorry, that's a whole... That's too much. Let me go back and go to the Anglican Communion, and rather than go through my own personal agonising, and suggest whether it would be a good thing if the Lambeth Conference, A, stopped calling itself Lambeth, B, wasn't held at Lambeth, and C, didn't automatically have the Archbishop of Canterbury at its head.
All those things would be good, but still it would be a worldwide gathering of bishops, and there is more to the church than bishops. And there is more to the church than the implication that these bishops can get together and do something useful when they do. Individually, my experience of bishops is most of them are basically good things, but get them together. And the timidity, the stupidity, the blockishness of the collective is a very bad thing. And you just multiply that by factors of 10 when you put them in Lambeth, or in Canterbury, in physical terms, at the moment. And you also add things to the mixture which are just awful, awful messages to the world. Like, some of these bishops are in same-sex partnerships, happy, fulfilled, an example to their congregations. But the partners, the spouses, if you like an old-fashioned word, have not been invited. they've been marginalised. They're not there like a traditional clergy wife like my mother in her hat with berries on, running the Mothers' Union. They have been treated as something other. And that's just awful symbolism.
I wonder if we could turn then to the Church of England, because as well as the Anglican Communion going through very difficult times, there's a big argument going on within the Church of England, obviously, about its future. And there are some who take the view that a group of people of, shall we say, evangelical persuasion, who put a primacy on conversion, are trying to run the church from the centre. And another group take a rather different view of what the church is. They prefer a almost devolved church, which doesn't ask too many questions about people's faith, but welcomes them in. Is that, do you think that's a real argument now? And do you think it's a dangerous argument?
It is dangerous. There is an exclusivity about evangelical, conservative evangelicalism of a certain sort. I mean, symbolised very brutally by a locked church door. When I see a church, when I go up to a church I don't know, and the door is locked, then I think, right, this place isn't for me. But when I see an open door and perhaps even a literal sign of welcome, I think, OK, this is my place as well as their place. And they've been generous enough to open it up. And you think back to lockdown and when churches were almost universally closed. That was a terrible decision. I actually knew of churches in the depths of a part of England I won't name, where the churches were obstinately open through all that.
I do too, not least eventually my own church, where basically the parishioners just revolted. And they say, we quite understand about COVID, we need to protect people and so on. But the idea that you close the church is deeply offensive. And I think the Archbishop of Canterbury, to fair to him, has acknowledged that he probably was a mistake. And the Archbishop of Westminster told me that he was had a pretty vigorous argument with the government, pointing out that food banks, whole raft of things central to the community were built around the church. And if you closed the church, you closed not only a building, but almost you closed off a section of society.
I'm glad to say that my own parish church was galvanised by that locked door and opened it as soon as possible and has opened itself much more to the local community than in the past. It now has what we call a parish pantry inside the church, and it's there and it's labelled, take no questions asked, don't take too much because other people might need them. And that's exactly the image that I want of a local church. It's a community, yes, it's a set of people who know each other and have a common identity, but they are open to others. That seems to be the generous, essential quality of the Church of England.
But there are people who will say, of course that's wonderful in one way, but the danger is that you stand for everything and nothing.
No, of course it isn't like that. You stand for the principles of worshipping God through the Christian tradition. And that's not negotiable. And it's just there. It's expressed by the nature of the building and so on. But it's what you do on top of that. And it's also that quality of generosity which does not demand things of those whom you're approaching from outside.
But you've written, of course, the most outstanding books about the Reformation, where justification by faith was something for which people would die. Are you now saying, in a way, they were mistaken and that such a concentration on justification by faith is not appropriate now?
They were promoting a good, which was to get rid of a certain sort of late medieval guilt and futility in the practice of religion. But the trouble about promoting one good is that you may well miss another one. And the bad thing about the Reformation was its awful dogmatism. I'm right, you're wrong, and I might even kill you because I think you're wrong. That was a terrible thing. Not all the Reformation was like that. England was, frankly, but in Eastern Europe, there were quite large areas which said, that's awful, the persecution of people. We won't do that. We'll allow people to worship in their own way, and we'll make actual formal agreements to make sure that they can. That was the way forward, and it's actually the way in which Christian churches operate now.
Why, at the beginning of our conversation, you said that you were, well, not using precisely these words, but you say you were, in effect, returning to the church, or perhaps another way, becoming a more enthusiastic member of it. And yet what you've described in the rest of this interview is a real anger and unhappiness with the way the church is going. So what is it that has changed you and brought you back more into the fold in the last few years?
Well, I'd say the constant practice of worship, which I adhered to sort of quite obstinately, even in the days when I felt fairly alienated from the institution. And the practice of worship in a very traditional way through the Book of Common Prayer and the music which has accompanied it in over the centuries since the Reformation, that seems to me an anchor. And also, I will have to say, the buildings. The literal buildings of them. I remember you in passing sort of said, well, buildings may be a problem. No, buildings are an asset. If
they can be both.
Absolutely, yes. They can drag you down. But used sensitively and imaginatively, they are a huge asset. They're a space of peace, tranquility, a place where you can be yourself at the best. And they must be allowed to be there for times when there is no congregation. There was the awful side of Protestantism and the Reformation, which deliberately locked the doors on the church so people couldn't pray in private. Now, isn't that stupid? But that was the way that the church in Geneva ran itself. The Church of Scotland still locks most of its doors. And, well, who can blame the people of Scotland for not going to the Church of Scotland anymore?
Well, a lot of people aren't going to the Church of England anymore. And I think a lot of people would identify with what you've said, but also would say, fine, but this is a declining church. This is a church of old people. This is a church where the cost of maintaining a priest in a parish is too much. We're amalgamating parishes. Where are we going to be in 40 years' time? If we don't do something, we will cease to exist. How do you answer them?
I don't have a good answer, but I do point to the parts of the church which are doing well, or the parts of the church which shout out that they're doing well are charismatic evangelical churches. But actually, the biggest success stories in the present Church of England are cathedrals, vastly expensive institutions, very elaborate with traditional music, etc. They have been a success in the last 15, 20 years. The people, not just visiting them, but going to their services, are rising in numbers. And they said to themselves, why are we being a success? They'd not done that terrible thing of saying we're going to be successful. They've just gone on doing what they do. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, there are headaches for deans and chapters and the like. But we need to celebrate such a success and take it as a gift to the rest of the church. You're right. How do you finance the traditional parish system? Well, it doesn't look as if you can in traditional ways. But the traditional parish system was not the church. It was a way of organizing the church from the 11th century to the 20th century. It worked, partly because everyone was forced to go to it. And now they're not, they don't. So you do have to listen to the voice of the Holy Spirit enacted in history and the way that society actually works.
Finally, can we return to the Anglican Communion and to Lambeth and to the issue of reparations, which is being discussed? Without going into detail, do you think that the Anglican Communion, or the Church of England as well, has inherited a responsibility which is not fully discharged to those parts of the community who suffered from slavery and, in the view of many of them, have been permanently damaged by slavery, that we have a special responsibility to those people and those countries and those communities?
Well, yes, we do. What form reparations might take is a difficult one, and it may not be finance. It may be contributing the scholarship that we can to the questions of how slavery worked, how the exploitation worked. It's all going to sound very woke, I'm afraid, because the story of slavery and of the British Empire is not an edifying one. There were some good things about it, but on the whole, there's a horrific strand to this story, and it's up to the Church of England not to flinch from that and say, yes, we have a responsibility for that. And to be frank, also, the Church of Ireland, the Church in Wales, they're all part of an imperial enterprise which needs constant re-examining.
But you see, there are others who would say, well, OK, we accept the ruling class or those people who had the vote. Yes, they have responsibility, but hold on. Some of our ancestors were working in factories at the age of 9. That was a form of slavery, didn't have the vote, and they're being told they are responsible in some way for slavery. They didn't benefit by it. The middle and upper classes did. Do you have any sympathy to that point of view?
I do, but that's where historians come in, because you can point out, well, yes, that's quite true about your ancestors, and that story needs to be told too. But they were part of an exploitative system. Their labour contributed to the whole cycle of finance there. To quote a previous statesman, education. We have the resources in this country to keep that program going, and let's use that. Let's give that to the world. It is a process of truth and reconciliation, and it's a really complicated one.
But it's one that should be perhaps higher on the agenda than issues of sexuality.
Certainly, very much so.
Professor Dermot McCulloch, thank you very much for talking to us. This has been the first of the podcasts from the Religion and Media Centre. I hope you enjoyed it, and will join us for the next one. Thank you.